You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, 10 lectures, entitled The Tension Between East and West. They were given during the Second International Congress of the Anthroposophical Movement in Vienna from the 1st of June to the 12th of June, 1922, translated by B.A. Rowley. This is Lecture 1, entitled Anthroposophy and Natural Science, given in Vienna on the 1st of June, 1922. This Congress has been announced as a Congress about worldviews, and no doubt you will take it as such. Anyone who wishes to talk about questions of worldviews today, however, cannot ignore natural science, and in particular the consequences that natural science has brought to bear on worldviews. Indeed, for centuries, since the 15th or 16th century, we may say, science has increasingly come to dominate human thinking in the cultural sphere. Now, it would take a great many words to survey the triumphs of science in the field of human knowledge, and the transformation of our whole life brought about by the achievements of scientific research. And it would be merely a repetition of what you all know already. In terms of worldviews, what is interesting about science is something quite different. I mean the function it long ago assumed of educating the whole civilized world. And it is precisely in discussing this educational role in the development of modern humanity that we come up against two paradoxes, as I should like to call them. Let me begin with these paradoxes. The first thing that has followed from the scientific method of research is a transformation of human thinking. Any impartial observer of earlier worldviews must conclude that because of the conditions that determined human development in those ancient times, thinking inevitably added something from the actual human element to what was given by experiment and the observation of nature. We need only recall those now outmoded branches of knowledge, astrology and alchemy, to perceive how nature was approached in former times in such a way that human thinking, as a matter of course, added to what was already there something that it wished to express or that it allowed to arise from the things of the world. In face of the scientific attitude of recent times, this has ceased. Today we are virtually obliged simply to accept the perceptions given us by observation and experiment, and to work them up into natural laws, as they are called. Admittedly, to do so we make use of thought, but we make use of it only as a means of arranging phenomena, so that through their own existence they manifest to us their inner connection, their conformity to law. And we make it our duty not to add any of our own thought to our observation of the world. We see this indeed as an ideal of the scientific attitude, and rightly so. Under these conditions, what has become of human thinking? It has actually become the servant, the mere tool of research. Thought, as such, has really nothing to contribute when it comes to investigating the lawfulness of external phenomena. Here, then, is one of my paradoxes, that thought, as a human experience, is excluded from the relationship that the human being enters into with the world. It has become a purely formal aid for comprehending realities. Within science, it is no longer something self-manifesting. The significance of this for the inner aspect of human life is extraordinarily great. It means that we must look upon thinking as something which must retire in wisdom and modesty when we are contemplating the outside world, and which represents a kind of private current within the life of the soul. And it is precisely when we now ask ourselves, how in turn can science approach thinking, that we come up against the paradox and find ourselves saying, if thinking has to confine itself to the arranging of natural processes and can intervene only formally in clarification, combination, and organization, it cannot also fall within the natural processes themselves. It thus becomes paradoxical to raise the question, which is certainly justified from the scientific point of view, how can we, from the standpoint of scientific law, understand thinking as a manifestation of the human organism? And to this, if we stand impartially and seriously within the life of science, we can only reply today, to the extent that thinking has had to withdraw from the natural processes, contemplation of them can go on trying to arrive at thinking, but it cannot succeed. Since it is methodologically excluded, thinking is also, in reality, excluded from the natural processes. It is condemned to be a mere semblance, not a reality. Not many people today, I believe, are fully conscious of the force of this paradox. Yet in the depths of their subconscious, there exists in countless numbers of people today an awareness of it. Only as thinking beings can we regard ourselves as human. It is in thinking that we find our human dignity. And yet this, which really makes us into human beings, accompanies us through the world as something whose reality we cannot at present acknowledge, as a semblance. In pointing to what is noblest in our human nature, we feel ourselves to be, in a certain sense, within a non-reality. This is something that burdens the soul of anyone who has become seriously involved with the research methods both of the inorganic sciences and of biology, and who wishes to draw upon the consequences of these methods, rather than of any individual results, for a worldview. Here, we may say, is something that can lead to bitter doubts in the human soul. Doubts arise first in the intellect, it is true, but they flow down into the realm of feelings. Anyone who is able to look at human nature more deeply and without prejudice, in the way I shall be demonstrating in detail in the lectures that follow, knows how a person's inner state, especially if certain traits of this inner state endure long enough, works right down into the physical state of the person, and how, from this physical state, or disposition, the mood of life wells up in turn. Whether the doubt is driven down into our feelings or not determines whether we stride courageously through life, so that we can stand upright ourselves and have a healthy influence among our fellows, or whether we wander through life disgruntled and downcast, useless to ourselves and useless to our fellows. I do not say, and the lectures which follow will show, that I do not need to say that what I have just been discussing must always lead to doubt, but it can easily do so, unless science is extended in the directions I shall be describing. The splendid achievements of science with regard to the external world make extraordinary demands upon the human soul, if, as we certainly must do from the philosophical standpoint here expounded, we adopt a positive attitude to science. They demand that we should be capable of meeting doubt with something stronger and more powerful than would be necessary if these demands did not derive from the sound results of natural science. Whilst in this respect science would appear to lead to something negative for the life of the soul, yet, and this brings me to my second paradox, on the other hand, it has resulted in something extremely positive. Here I express once more a paradox that struck me particularly when, more than 20 years ago, I worked out my philosophy of freedom and attempted, while maintaining a truly scientific worldview, to penetrate the nature of human freedom. For with its lawfulness, science does easily lead, in theory, to a denial of human freedom. In this respect, however, science produces theories that are just the opposite of what it develops in practice. When we enter ever more earnestly into the pictorial nature of thinking, and by actually pursuing the scientific attitude, not scientific theories, arrive at a right inward experience of that nature, then we conclude, if it is only an image and not a reality, then the process of thought does not, like a natural force, have a compelling effect. I may thus compare it, and this is more than a mere comparison, to a combination of mirror images. Images before me cannot compel me. Existent forces can compel me, whether they are thought of as existing outside me or inside me. Images cannot compel me. If, therefore, I am able to conceive my moral impulses within that pure thinking which science itself fosters in us by its methods, if I can so shape moral impulses within me that I live in relation to their shaping within the same thinking to which science educates me, then in these moral impulses grasped in pure thinking, I have not compelling forces, but forces and images according to which I alone can define myself. That is to say, however much science, from its very premises, is bound, and with some justification, to deny freedom, yet by educating to pictorial thinking, it educates the person of our culture to freedom. These are the two poles, the one relating to the life of thought and the other to the life of the will, with which the human soul is confronted by contemporary scientific views. In distinguishing them, however, we indicate at the same time how the scientific worldview points beyond itself. It must take up some attitude toward human thinking, yet it excludes that thinking. By so doing, it suggests a method of research that can be fully justified in the eyes of science and yet lead to a comprehensible experience of thinking. It suggests, on the other hand, that because it cannot itself arrive theoretically at freedom, the scientific attitude must be extended into a different region, precisely in order to reach the sphere of freedom. What I am presenting as a necessity deriving from science itself, an extension into a region that science, at least as understood today, cannot reach, is attempted by the worldview I am here advocating. Today, of course, since it stands at the beginning of its development, it can achieve this extension only imperfectly. Yet the attempt must be made, for the soul experiences of thinking and freedom that I have described are spreading among more and more souls today. It is no longer possible for us today to believe that only those in some way involved with science are faced with demands and questions and riddles of this kind. Even the remotest villages, to which no scientific results of any consequence penetrate, are, nevertheless, brought by their education to the kind of thinking that science demands. And this brings with it, though quite unconsciously as yet, uncertainty about human freedom. It is therefore not only scientific questions that are involved here, but quite clearly universal human questions. What it comes to is this. Taking our stand on the ground of scientific education, can we penetrate further along the path of knowledge than does contemporary science? The attempt to do so can be made, and made in such a way that the methods used can be justified to the strictest scientist, and made by paths that have been laid down in complete accordance with the scientific attitude and with scientific conscientiousness. I should like now, at the start of my lectures, to go on to speak of these paths. Yet, although many souls already unconsciously long for it, this path of knowledge is still not easy to explain conceptually. In order that we may be able to understand one another this evening, therefore, I should like to introduce, simply as aids to understanding, descriptions of older paths that humanity has followed in order to arrive at knowledge lying beyond the usual region science deals with today. Much of what people today regard as an object of faith, but not at all an object of knowledge, that is, what has emerged as tradition in the course of humanity's evolution, what lives still today as honorable tradition, and is as such accepted as the content of faith, this, from the perspective of a truly unbiased study of history, derives from older methods of knowledge that are no longer appropriate for our contemporary culture. Everything concerning which people today believe that it ought to remain an inner matter of faith, everything that is accepted as time-honored tradition, leads the psychologically perceptive student of history back to ancient epochs of humanity. There it is revealed that these matters of faith were sought after as matters of knowledge suited to their time by certain individuals through the cultivation of their own souls and the development of hidden spiritual powers, and that they thus genuinely constituted matters of knowledge. People today no longer realize how much of what has emerged historically in humanity's development was once actually discovered, but discovered by earlier paths of knowledge. When I describe these paths, I do so, of course, with the aid of methods I will outline later, so that, in many cases, those who form their picture of the earlier epochs of humanity only from outward historical documents and not from spiritual documents may take exception to my description. Anyone who examines impartially even the outward historical documents and who then compares them with what I shall have to say will nevertheless find no real contradiction. And furthermore, I want to emphasize that I am not describing these older paths of knowledge in order to advocate them today. They suited earlier epochs, and nowadays can even be harmful to someone who, under a misapprehension, applies them to himself. It is only so that we understand each other about contemporary methods of knowledge that I will choose two earlier paths, describe them, and thus make clear the paths one has to walk today if one wishes to go beyond the sphere of scientific knowledge as it is now understood. As I have said, I could select others from the wealth of earlier paths of knowledge, but I am selecting only two. First, then, we have a path that, in its pure form, was followed by individuals in ancient times in the Orient, the path of yoga. Yoga has passed through many phases, and the aspect to which I will attach the greatest value today is precisely one that has come down to later epochs in a thoroughly decadent and harmful state, so that the historian, when considering later epochs, will thus be forced to present what I will describe as something actually harmful to man. But in successive epochs, human nature has experienced the most varied developments. Something quite different suited human nature in ancient epochs than in later ones. What could in earlier times be a genuine method of knowledge was later perhaps used only to titillate people's itch for power over their fellow human beings. This was certainly not the case in the earliest periods, when the yoga I wish to characterize was practiced. What did it comprise, this path of yoga, that was followed in very ancient times in the Orient by individuals who were scholars, to use the modern term, in higher spheres? It comprised, among other things, particular kinds of breathing exercises. I am singling out breathing exercises from the wealth of exercises that the yoga pupil or the yoga scholar, the yogi, had to undertake. When nowadays we examine our breathing, we find that it is a process which, for the most part, operates unconsciously in the healthy human organism. Only when we have some kind of sickness do we notice our breathing. The more that the process of breathing functions matter-of-factly in our life, the better it is for ordinary consciousness and for ordinary life. For the duration of his exercises, however, when he wished to develop cognitive powers that are merely dormant in ordinary consciousness, the yogi transformed the process of respiration. He did so by employing a length of time for inhaling, for holding the breath, and for exhaling that was different from the usual length in ordinary natural breathing. Why did he do this? He did this so as to make conscious the process of respiration. Ordinary respiration does not become conscious. The transformed respiratory rhythm, with its timing determined by human volition, is entirely conscious. But what is the result? Well, we have only to express ourselves in physiological terms to realize what the yogi achieved by making conscious his respiration. When we breathe in, the respiratory impulse enters our organism, but it also goes via the spinal cord into the brain. There, the rhythm of the respiratory current combines with those processes that are the physical carriers of thought life, the nerve sense processes. Actually, in our ordinary thought life, we never have nerve sense processes alone. They are always permeated by our respiratory rhythm. A connection, interaction, harmonization of the nerve sense processes and of respiration always occurs when we allow our thought life to take its course. By transmitting his altered respiratory rhythm into the nerve sense process in a fully conscious way, the yogi now consciously connected the respiratory rhythm with the thought rhythm, with the logical rhythm, or better said, with the logical combination and analysis of thoughts. In this way, he altered his whole thought life. In what direction did he alter it? Precisely because his breathing became fully conscious, his thoughts permeated his organism in the same way as did the respiratory current itself. We could say that the yogi set his thoughts moving on the respiratory currents, and in the inner rhythm of his being, felt himself filled with thoughts that were living on the currents of the breath. In this way, the yoga scholar raised himself above the mass of his fellow human beings, and was able to proclaim to them knowledge they could not gain for themselves. In order to understand what was really happening here, we must look for a moment at the particular way in which knowledge at that time affected the ordinary popular consciousness of the masses. Nowadays, when we look out at the world, we attach the greatest value to seeing pure colors, to hearing pure sounds, and similarly, to obtaining a certain purity in the other perceptions, such purity that is as the sensory process can afford. This was not true for human consciousness in older civilizations. It is not the case, as a certain brand of scholarship often mistakenly believes, the people in earlier times projected all sorts of imaginings onto nature. The imagination was not all that unusually active. Because of the human constitution at that time, however, it was quite natural for older civilizations not to see only pure colors, pure sounds, pure qualities in the other senses, but at the same time to perceive in everything something soul-spiritual. Thus in sun and moon, in stars, in wind and weather, in spring and brook, in the creatures of nature's various realms, they saw something spiritual, where we today see pure colors and hear pure sounds, the connections between which we only later seek to understand with the aid of purified thinking. And there was a further consequence of this for earlier humanity, that no such strong and inwardly fortified self-consciousness as we have today existed then. Besides perceiving something spiritual in everything about him, man perceived himself as a part of this whole environment. He did not separate himself from it as an independent self. To draw an analogy, I might say, if my hand were conscious, what would it think about itself? It would conclude that it was not an independent entity, but made sense only within my organism. In some such way as this, the human being of earlier times was unable to regard himself as an independent entity, but felt himself, rather, a part of nature's whole, which in turn he had to see as permeated by spirit and soul. The yogi raised himself above this view, which implied the dependence of the human I, capital. By uniting his thinking to a certain extent with the process of respiration that fills the whole inner being of man, he arrived at a comprehension of the human self, the human I. What for us today is self-evident through our inherited qualities, and if we are adults, through our education, namely that we feel ourselves as a self, as an I, had to be attained in those earlier times indirectly through exercises. The consequence was that the yogi obtained from the experience of self something quite different from what we do. It is one thing to accept something as a natural experience, as the sense of self is for us, and quite another to attain to it by the paths that were followed in early Oriental civilization. They lived with what moves and swells and acts in the universe, whereas today, when we experience all this from a certain elevation, we no longer experience anything of the universe directly. Therefore, human selfhood, the true human soul being, manifested itself to the yogi through his exercises. And we may say, since what could be discovered in this way passed over as revelation into the general cultural consciousness, it became the content of the most important spiritual products of earlier times. Once again, I would like to take one example out of many. Here we have, coming resplendently down to us from the ancient Orient, the magnificent song, the title Bhagavad Gita. In the Gita, we have the experience of self-awareness. It describes wonderfully, out of the deepest human lyricism, how, when he experientially comprehends it, comprehendingly experiences it, this self leads man to a sympathy with the all, and how it reveals to him his own humanity and his relationship with a higher world, with a spiritual and supersensible world. In ever new and marvelous notes, the Gita depicts this awareness of the self in its devotion to the all. To the impartial observer of history, who can immerse himself in these earlier times, it is clear that the splendid notes of the Gita have arisen from what could be experienced through these exercises in cognition. This way of attaining knowledge was appropriate for an earlier epoch of civilization in the Orient. At that time it was generally accepted that one had to retire into solitude and a hermit's life if one sought connection with supersensible worlds. And anyone who carried out such exercises did condemn himself to solitude and the life of the hermit. For these exercises bring one into a certain state of sensitivity and make one overly sensitive to the robust external world. One must retire from life. In earlier times, it was just such solitary figures who were trusted by their fellow human beings. What they had to say was accepted as knowledge. Nowadays, this no longer suits our civilization. People today rightly demand that anyone who is to be trusted as a source of knowledge should stand in the midst of life, should be able to hold his own with the robustness of life, with human labor and human activity, as the demands of the time shape them. People today just do not feel themselves linked, as people of earlier epochs did, to anyone who has to withdraw from life. If you reflect carefully on this, you will conclude, contemporary paths of knowledge must be different. We shall be speaking of these in a little while. But before doing so, and again simply by way of explanation, and not with any idea of recommending it, I want to describe the principles underlying a path that was also appropriate to earlier times, a path of asceticism. The path of asceticism involved a subduing and damping down of bodily processes and needs, so that the human body no longer functioned in its normal, robust fashion. Bodily functions were also subdued by subjecting the external physical organism to painful conditions. All this gave to those who followed this ascetic path certain human experiences that did indeed bring knowledge. I do not, of course, mean that it is right to inhibit the healthy human organism in which we are born into this life on earth, where our aim is to enable this organism to be effective in ordinary life. The healthy organism is unquestionably the appropriate one for external sensory nature, which is, after all, the basis of human life between birth and death. Yet it remains true that the early ascetics, who had damped down this organism, did in fact gain pure experience of their souls, and with their souls knew themselves to inhabit a spiritual world. What makes our physical sensory organism suited for the life between birth and death is precisely the fact that, as the ascetics' experiences were able to show, it hides from us the spiritual world. It was, quite simply, the experience of the early ascetics that by damping down the bodily functions, one could consciously enter the spiritual worlds. This, again, is not a path that can be followed today. Anyone who inhibits his body in this way makes himself unfit for life among his contemporaries, and makes himself unfit in relation to himself as well. Life today demands people who do not withdraw, who maintain their health, and indeed restore it if it is impaired, but not people who withdraw from life. Such people could inspire no confidence simply because of the attitude of our age. Although the path of asceticism certainly did lead to knowledge in earlier times, it cannot be a path for today. Yet what both the path of yoga and the ascetic path yielded in terms of knowledge of the supersensible world is preserved in ancient and, I would say, sacred traditions, and is accepted by humanity today as satisfying certain needs of the soul. And people are not interested to know that the articles of faith, thus accepted, were in fact discovered by a genuine path of knowledge, though one no longer suited to our age. Today's path of knowledge must be entirely different. We have seen how the one path, yoga, tried to arrive at thinking indirectly through breathing, in order to experience this thinking in a way in which it is not perceived in ordinary life. For the reason already given, we cannot make this detour via breathing. We must therefore try to achieve a transformation of thinking by other means, so that through this transformed thinking we can reach knowledge that will be a kind of extension of the knowledge of nature. If we understand ourselves correctly, therefore, we shall start today not by changing thinking indirectly via the breath, but by changing it directly by means of certain exercises through which we make thinking inwardly stronger and more energetic than it is in ordinary consciousness. In ordinary consciousness, we indulge in rather passive thinking that adheres to the course of external events. To follow a new supersensible path of knowledge, we place certain readily comprehended concepts at the center of our consciousness. We remain within the thought itself. I am aware that many people believe that what I am now going to describe is present already in the later path of yoga, for example, in that of Patanjali. But as practiced today, it certainly does not form a part of Oriental spiritual training. For if a person were to carry out the yoga exercises today, they would have, because of the change in the human organism, a different effect than they had on the people of earlier epochs. Thus today we turn directly to thinking, namely by cultivating meditation, by concentrating on certain thought contents for certain lengths of time. We perform, in the realm of the soul, something comparable to building up a muscle. If we use a muscle over and over again in continuous exertion, whatever the goal and purpose, the muscle must develop. We can do the same with thinking. Instead of always submitting, in our thinking, to the course of external events, we bring into the center of our consciousness, with a great effort of will, readily comprehended thoughts, which we have formed ourselves or which have been given to us by someone knowledgeable in this area, and in which no memories can persist, of which we are not conscious. We shut out all other consciousness and concentrate only on this one subject. In the words of Goethe in Faust, I might say, yes, it is easy, that is, it appears so, yet the easy is difficult. One person must do this for weeks, another for months. When consciousness does learn to rest, and to rest over and over again, upon the same content in such a way that the content itself becomes a matter of complete indifference, and one devotes all one's attention and all one's inward experience to the strengthening, to the soul energizing of the life of thought, then, at last, one achieves the opposite process to what the yogi went through. That is, we tear our thinking away from the breathing process. Today, this still seems absurd, fantastic. Yet just as the yogi pushed his thinking toward the interior of the body, to connect it with the rhythm of his breath, and in this way experience his own self, his inner spirituality, so, too, do we release thinking from the remnant of the breathing process that lives unconsciously in all our ordinary thinking. You will find the systematic exercises described in greater detail in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, or in title An Outline of Occult Science, or again in title Riddles of the Soul, and other books of mine. By these means, one gradually succeeds not only in separating the thought sequence from the breathing process, but in making it altogether free of corporeality. Only then does one see what a great service the so-called materialistic, or rather mechanistic, worldview has rendered to humanity. It has made us aware that ordinary thinking stands on the foundation of bodily processes. From this can stem the incentive to seek a thinking that no longer rests on bodily processes. But this can only be found by building up ordinary thinking in the way described. By doing so, we arrive at a body-free thinking, a thinking that consists purely of soul processes. In this way, what once had an image nature in us, we come to know at first only as images, but images that show us life independent of our corporeality. This is the first step toward a path of knowledge suited to modern people. It brings us, however, to an experience that is hidden from ordinary consciousness. Just as the Indian yogi linked himself in his thinking with the internal rhythm of breathing, so also with his spiritual self, which lives in the breathing rhythm, just as he moved inward, so we go outward. By tearing our logical thinking away from the organism to which it is actually connected, we penetrate with this thinking into the external rhythm of the world, and discover for the first time that such a rhythm exists. Just as the yogi made conscious the inner rhythm of his body, so we become conscious in a spiritual way of an external world rhythm. If I may express myself metaphorically, in ordinary consciousness we combine our thoughts logically and thus make use of thinking to know the external sensory world. Now, however, we allow thinking to enter into a kind of musical element, but one that is undoubtedly a knowledge element. we become aware of a spiritual rhythm underlying all things. We penetrate into the world by beginning to perceive it in the spirit. From abstract, dead thinking, from mere image thinking, our thinking becomes a thinking enlivened in itself. This is the significant transition that can be made from abstract and merely logical thinking to a living thinking, about which we have the feeling it is capable of shaping a reality, just as we recognize our process of growth as a living reality. With this living thinking, however, we can now penetrate deeper into nature than with ordinary thinking. In what way? Let me illustrate this with an example taken from modern life, although the example is a much disputed one. We direct our abstract thought activity, for instance, toward a higher animal, observing and experimenting. With this thinking, we create for ourselves an inner image of how the organs of the animal are arranged, the skeleton, musculature, and so on, and how the life processes flow into one another. We make a thought image of the animal. Then, with the same thinking, we pass to the human being, and once again make a thought image of him, the configuration of his skeleton, his musculature, the interaction of his life processes, and so on. We can then make an external comparison between the two images obtained. If we tend toward a Darwinian approach, we shall regard the human being as a descendant of the animals through an actual physical process. If we are more spiritually and idealistically inclined, we imagine the relationship differently. We will not go into that now. The important thing is that because our thinking is dead and abstract, we are not in a position, once we have formed a thought image of the animal, to pass over to the image of man out of the inner life of thinking itself. Instead, we have first to extract our ideas, our thought images, from the sensory realities, and then to compare these ideas with one another. When, on the other hand, we have advanced to living thinking, we do indeed still form a thought image. But now it is a living thought image of the skeleton, the musculature, and the interaction of vital processes in the animal. Because our thought has now become a living one, we can pursue it inwardly as a living structure and pass over in the thought itself to the image of man. I might say, the thought of the animal grows into the thought of the human being. How this works, I can only suggest by means of an example. If we have a magnetic needle in front of us, we know that there is only one position in which it remains at rest, and that is when its axis coincides with the north-south direction of the Earth's magnetism. This direction is exceptional. To all other directions, the needle is indifferent. Everything we have before us in this example becomes, for living thinking, an experience with respect to all of space. For living thinking, space is no longer an aimless juxtaposition as it is for dead, abstract thinking. Space becomes internally differentiated. And we learn the significance of the fact that in animals the spine is essentially horizontal. Where this is not the case, we can demonstrate from a deeper lawfulness that the abnormality is particularly significant. But in essence, an animal spine lies in the horizontal plane, we may say parallel to the surface of the earth. Now, it is not immaterial whether the spinal cord runs in this direction, or in the vertical direction to which the human being raises himself in the course of his life. Thus we come to know in living thinking that if we wanted to place the line of the animal upright, that is to orient it differently in the universe, we would have to transform all its other organs. Thought becomes living, simply through the rotation of 90 degrees from the horizontal to the vertical orientation. We pass over in this way by an inner impulse from the animal to the human form. thus by first dipping down into the rhythm of the natural process, and thereby arriving at the spiritual element underlying nature, we penetrate further into the inner realm of the natural process. We attain in our living thinking something with which we can penetrate into the growth and becoming of the outer world. We reach once more the secrets of existence, from which we departed in the course of human evolution through the unfolding of I-consciousness, of the feeling of self. Now, you can all raise a weighty objection here. You can say, for example, there have indeed been individuals with thinking that is supposedly living, but the present age, with its insistence on serious research, has rightly turned away from, in quotes, living thinking, as it was expounded, for instance, by the philosopher Schelling, or the natural philosopher Olkin. I myself agree entirely with those who raise this kind of objection. There is something quite fantastic, something that leaves reality behind and breathes no actuality, about the way in which pictorial ideas gained from external processes and substances are inwardly enlivened by Olkin and Schelling, and then applied to other natural facts and creatures in order to see, quote, in the manner of nature, close quote, so to speak. So long as our living thinking does not pass on to a mode of knowledge other than this, we cannot, even with its aid, reach any assurance of reality. Only by adding exercises of the will to the thought exercises do we secure, in living thoughts, a guarantee of spiritual reality. Exercises of the will can be characterized as follows. Let us be quite honest with ourselves. In ordinary life, if we think back 10 or 20 years, we have to conclude, in the actual content of the life of our soul, we have in many ways become different people. But we have done so by more or less passively submitting, as children, to heredity, environment, and education, and in later life to life itself. Anyone who wishes to attain knowledge of spiritual reality must take in hand, if I may use this somewhat coarse expression, by an inner education and discipline of the will, what is usually experienced rather passively. Here again you will find the relevant exercises, which are intimate exercises of the soul, described in the books I have named. Today I can only indicate briefly what is involved. At present, we have certain habits that perhaps we did not have 10 years ago, since life has only recently imposed them on us. Similarly, we can decide to adopt these or those qualities of character. The best thing is to adopt qualities of character that require you to work on yourself for years on end in order to form them, so that you must direct attention over and over again to that strengthening and fortifying of the will which is connected with such self-discipline. If you take in hand the development of your will like this, so that you, in part, make of yourself what the world would otherwise make of you as a person, then the living thoughts into which you have found your way through meditation and concentration take on a quite special aspect for your experience. Namely, they increasingly become painful experiences, inward sufferings of the soul. And in the last analysis, nobody can attain to higher knowledge who has not passed through these experiences of suffering and pain. We must pass through and conquer these experiences, so that we incorporate and go beyond them, gaining a neutral attitude toward them once more. What is going on here can be represented as follows. Take the human eye, EYE. What I am saying here could be expounded scientifically in every detail, but I have time only for a general outline. As light and color affect it, changes occur in its physical interior. An earlier humanity, undoubtedly, perceived these as suffering and mild pain. And if we were not so robust and did not remain indifferent to them because of our makeup, we also could not help but experience the changes in eye and ear as mild pain. all sensory perception is ultimately built on pain and suffering. In thus permeating the entire life of our soul, painfully and in suffering, with living thoughts, we permeate the body, not in the manner of the ascetic, with pain and suffering. We keep it healthy to suit the demands of ordinary life, but we inwardly and intimately experience pain and suffering in the soul. Anyone who has made some progress toward higher knowledge will always tell you, "The pleasure and joy that life has brought me I gratefully accept from fate, but I owe my knowledge to my pain and suffering." In this way, life itself prepares the knowledge seeker for the fact that part of the path he travels involves the conquest of suffering and pain. For if we overcome this suffering and pain, we make our entire soul being into a sense organ, or rather a spirit organ, a soul organ. And now we learn to look into the spiritual world, just as through our ordinary senses we look into and listen to the physical world. I do not need to discuss epistemological considerations today. I am naturally familiar with the objection that the external mode of knowledge must first also be investigated, but that does not concern us today. What I want to say is simply this: in the same sense in which, in ordinary life, we find the external physical world substantiated by our sensory perceptions, we find, after the soul's suffering has been conquered, the spiritual world substantiated by our soul organ, our spirit organ, which we have become as a complete soul spiritual human being. With this way of beholding, which I would like to call modern exact clairvoyance, in contrast to all earlier nebulous clairvoyant arts which belong to the past, we can also penetrate into the eternal being of man. We can penetrate with exactitude into the meaning of human immortality. But consideration of this must be reserved for tomorrow's lecture, where I shall be speaking about the special relationship of this worldview to questions of the human soul. Today I wish to show how, in contrast to earlier paths of knowledge, one can attain a modern, supersensible path of knowledge. The yogi sought to penetrate to the self within man's being. We seek to penetrate out to the rhythm of the world. The ancient ascetic suppressed the body in order to squeeze the spiritual experience out and allow it to exist independently. The modern path of knowledge does not incline to asceticism. It avoids all arts of castigation and addresses itself intimately to the very life of the soul. Both the modern paths, therefore, place the human being entirely within life. Whereas the paths of asceticism and yoga drew the human being away from life. I have tried today to describe to you a path that can be followed by developing powers of knowledge, now dormant in the soul, in a more spiritual sense than they were formerly developed. By doing this, however, I should like to suggest in conclusion, we also reach deeper into nature's being. The worldview of which I speak stands in no sort of opposition to the science of today. On the contrary, it takes precisely the genuine attitude of inquiry present in scientific research, and through its exercises develops this as a separate human faculty. Science today seeks exactness and feels particularly satisfied if it can achieve it by applying mathematics to natural processes. Why is this? It is because the perceptions provided by external nature through the senses for observation and experiment are wholly outside us. We permeate them with something we develop solely in our innermost being, with mathematical knowledge. And Kant's saying is often quoted, and even more often practiced by scientific thinkers: in all true knowledge, there is only so much science as there is mathematics. This is one-sided if we are thinking of ordinary mathematics, And yet when we apply this mathematics to lifeless natural phenomena, and nowadays even regard it as an ideal, for instance, to be able to count the chromosomes in the blastoderm, we reveal how satisfied we are if we can permeate with mathematics what otherwise stands outside us. Why? Because mathematics is experienced inside us with immediate certainty. We often have to represent this experience to ourselves by means of diagrams, but the diagrams are not essential to the certainty, the truth. The mathematical element is seen and discovered within us. And what we find within us, we connect with what we see outside. In this way, we feel satisfied. Anyone who perceives this process of cognition in its entirety must conclude things can satisfy the human being as knowledge and lead to a science only if they rest on something he can really experience and observe through his inner powers. With the aid of mathematics, we can penetrate into the facts and structures of the inorganic world. But we cannot move more than a little way at most, and that somewhat primitively, into the organic world. We need an inner seeing, as exact as that of mathematics, with which to penetrate into the higher processes of the outer world. Even one of the outstanding representatives of the school of Haeckel has expressly admitted that we must advance to an entirely different type of research and observation if we wish to move up from the inorganic into the organic realm of nature. For the inorganic, we have mathematics, geometry. For the organic, for the living, we have nothing as yet that can be inwardly formed like a triangle, a circle, or an ellipse. Through living thinking, we achieve this, not with ordinary mathematics for numbers and figures, but with a higher mathesis, with a beholding that is qualitative, that actively shapes. One that, and here I must say something which many people will find abominable, reaches up into the artistic realm. By penetrating with mathematics of this kind into worlds we cannot otherwise penetrate, we extend the scientific attitude upward into the biological sphere. And we may be sure that eventually the epoch will come when people will say, earlier epochs rightly emphasized that the degree to which science can be gained from inorganic nature depends proportionally on how much quantitative mathematics, in the broadest sense, can be applied to it. The degree to which science can be gained from living processes depends on the extent to which we are able to penetrate them with an inwardly living thought structure, with an exact clairvoyance. People will not believe how close this modern kind of clairvoyance is, in reality, to the mathematical view. Eventually, when it is realized, how from the spirit of modern nature knowledge, spirit knowledge can be gained, this spiritual science will be found to be justified precisely from the standpoint of our modern knowledge of nature. It has no wish to run counter to the important and imposing results of natural science. It seeks to attempt something different, just as when we look with our external senses at the physical form of someone standing before us, his gestures, the play of his features, the individual expression of his eyes, and yet perceive merely externals if we do not look through all this to something spiritual in him, by which alone the whole human being stands before us. So too, if we do not travel the ways of the spirit, we look with science only at the external physiognomy of the world, its gestures, its expressions. Only when we penetrate beyond the outward physiognomy that natural phenomena present to us, beyond the expressions and gestures, into the spiritual region of the world, do we recognize something to which we are ourselves related as the eternal element of the world. That is the aim of the spiritual science, whose methods I have sought to describe to you today by way of introduction. This spiritual science does not wish to impose triumphant modern science, but to accept it fully in its importance and essence, just as we accept fully the external human being. But just as we look through the external human being at the soul, so it seeks to penetrate through natural laws, not in an amateurish and dilettante fashion, but with a serious approach to the spiritual soul element underlying the world. And so this spiritual science seeks not to create any kind of opposition to natural science, but to be its soul, its spirit. The end of Lecture 1.